0130 hours. The sub came to rest gently on the bottom, beside the habitat. Norman stepped into the submarine airlock, flooded the chamber. Moments later, he climbed down the side and walked toward the habitat. The TVAC explosives cones, with their blinking red lights, looked oddly festive. "Your attention, please. 14 minutes and counting." He estimated the time he would need. 1 minute to get inside, 5, maybe 6 minutes to dress Beth and Harry in the suits, another 4 minutes to reach the sub and get them aboard, 2 or 3 minutes to make the ascent. It was going to be close. He moved beneath the big support pylons under the habitat.
"So you came back, Norman,"
Beth said over the intercom. "Yes, Beth."
"Thank God,"
she said. She started to cry. He was beneath ASIL, hearing her sobs over the intercom. He found the hatch cover, spun the wheel to open it. It was locked shut. "Beth, open the hatch." She was crying over the intercom. She didn't answer him. "Beth, can you hear me? Open the hatch." Crying like a child, sobbing hysterically.
"Norman," she said, "please help me, please."
"I'm trying to help you, Beth. Open the hatch."
"I can't."
"What do you mean you can't?"
"It won't do any good."
"Beth," he said, "come on now."
"I can't do it, Norman."
"Of course you can. Open the hatch, Beth."
"You shouldn't have come back, Norman."
There was no time for this now. "Beth, pull yourself together. Open the hatch."
"No, Norman, I can't."
And she began crying again. He tried all the hatches, one after another. B-sill locked, C-sill locked, D-sill locked. "Your attention, please. 13 minutes and counting." He was standing by E-sill, which had been flooded in an earlier attack. He saw the gaping, jagged tear in the outer cylinder surface. The hole was large enough for him to climb through, but the edges were sharp, and if he tore his suit... No, he decided, it was too risky. He moved beneath E-sill. Was there a hatch? He found a hatch, spun the wheel. It opened easily. He pushed the circular lid upward, heard it clang against the inner wall.
"Norman, is that you?"
He hauled himself up, into E-sill. He was panting from the exertion, on his hands and knees on the deck of E-sill. He shut the hatch and locked it again, then took a moment to get his breath. "Your attention, please. 12 minutes and counting." Jesus, he thought, already? Something white drifted past his faceplate, startling him. He pulled back, realized it was a box of cornflakes. When he touched it, the cardboard disintegrated in his hands, the flakes like yellow snow. He was in the kitchen. Beyond the stove, he saw another hatch leading to D-sill. D-sill was not flooded, which meant that he must somehow pressurize E-sill. He looked up, saw an overhead bulkhead hatch leading to the living room with the gaping tear. He climbed up quickly. He needed to find gas, some kind of tanks. The living room was dark, except for the reflected light from the floodlights, which filtered in through the tear. Cushions and padding floated in the water. Something touched him, and he spun and saw dark hair streaming around a face, and as the hair moved, he saw part of the face was missing, torn away grotesquely. Tina. Norman shuddered, pushed her body away. It drifted off, moving upward. "Your attention, please. 11 minutes and counting." It was all happening too fast, he thought. There was hardly enough time left. He needed to be inside the habitat now. No tanks in the living room. He climbed back down to the kitchen, shutting the hatch above. He looked at the stove, the ovens. He opened the oven door, and a burst of gas bubbled out, air trapped in the oven. But that couldn't be right, he thought, because gas was still coming out. A trickle of bubbles continued to come from the open oven. A steady trickle. What had Barnes said about cooking under pressure? There was something unusual about it he couldn't remember exactly. Did they use gas? Yes, but they also needed more oxygen. That meant... He pulled the stove away from the wall, grunting with exertion, and then he found it. A squat bottle of propane and 2 large blue tanks. Oxygen tanks. He twisted the Y-valves, his gloved fingers clumsy. Gas began to roar out. The bubbles rushed up to the ceiling, where the gas was trapped, the big air bubble that was forming. He opened the second oxygen tank. The water level fell rapidly to his waist, then his knees, then it stopped. The tanks must be empty. No matter, the level was low enough. Your attention, please. 10 minutes and counting. Norman opened the bulkhead door to D-Sill and stepped through into the habitat. The light was dim. A strange green, slimy mold covered the walls. On the couch, Harry lay unconscious, the intravenous line still in his arm. Norman pulled the needle out with a spurt of blood. He shook Harry, trying to rouse him. Harry's eyelids fluttered, but he was otherwise unresponsive. Norman lifted him, put him over his shoulder, carried him through the habitat. On the intercom, Beth was still crying, "Norman, you shouldn't have come." "Where are you, Beth?" On the monitors, he read, "Detonation sequence 0932. Counting backward. The numbers seemed to move too fast. "Take Harry and go, Norman. Both of you go. Leave me behind." "Tell me where you are, Beth." He was moving through the habitat from D to C-Sill. He didn't see her anywhere. Harry was a dead weight on his shoulder, making it difficult to get through the bulkhead doors.
"It won't do any good, Norman."
"Come on, Beth."
"I know I'm bad, Norman. I know I can't be helped."
"Beth." He was hearing her through the helmet radio, so he could not locate her by the sound, but he could not risk removing his helmet, not now.
"I deserve to die, Norman."
"Cut it out, Beth."
"Attention, please. 9 minutes and counting."
A new alarm sounded, an intermittent beeping that became louder and more intense as the seconds ticked by. He was in B-Sill, a maze of pipes and equipment. Once clean and multicolored, now the slimy mold coated every surface. In some places, fibrous, mossy strands hung down. B-Sill looked like a jungle swamp. "Beth." She was silent now. She must be in this room, he thought. B-Sill had always been Beth's favorite place, the place where the habitat was controlled. He put Harry on the deck, propped him against a wall. But the wall was slippery, and Harry slid down, banged his head. He coughed, opened his eyes. "Jesus." "Norman?" Norman held his hand up, signaling Harry to be quiet. "Beth?" Norman said. No answer. Norman moved among the slimy pipes. "Beth?"
"Leave me, Norman."
"I can't do that, Beth. I'm taking you, too."
"No, I'm staying, Norman."
"Beth," he said, "there's no time for this."
"I'm staying, Norman. I deserve to stay."
He saw her. Beth was huddled in the back, wedged among pipes, crying like a child. She held one of the explosive-tipped spear guns in her hand. She looked at him tearfully.
"Oh, Norman," she said, "you were going to leave us."
"I'm sorry. I was wrong." He started toward her, holding out his hands to her. She swung the spear gun around.
"No, you were right. You were right. I want you to leave now."
Above her head, he saw a glowing monitor, the numbers clicking inexorably backward. 0827, 0826. He thought, "I can change this. I want the numbers to stop counting." The numbers did not stop.
"You can't fight me, Norman," she said, huddled in the corner. Her eyes blazed with furious energy.
"I can see that."
"There isn't much time, Norman. I want you to leave."
She held the gun, pointed firmly toward him. He had a sudden sense of the absurdity of it all, that he had come back to rescue someone who didn't want to be rescued. What could he do now? Beth was wedged back in there, beyond his reach, beyond his help. There was barely enough time for him to get away, let alone to take Harry. Harry, he thought suddenly. Where was Harry now? "I want Harry to help me." But he wondered if there was time. The numbers were clicking backward. There was hardly more than 8 minutes now. "I came back for you, Beth."
"Go," she said. "Go now, Norman."
"But Beth."
"No, Norman. I mean it. Go. Why don't you go?"
And then she began to get suspicious. She started to look around. And at that moment, Harry stood up behind her and swung the big wrench down on her head. And there was a sickening thud, and she fell.
"Did I kill her?"
Harry said. And the deep male voice said, "Attention, please. 8 minutes and counting." Norman concentrated on the clock as it ticked backwards. "Stop. Stop the countdown." But when he looked again, the clock was still ticking backwards. And the alarm. Was the alarm interfering with his concentration? He tried again. "Stop now. The countdown will stop now. The countdown has stopped."
"Forget it,"
Harry said. "It won't work."
"But it should work,"
Norman said. "Nope," Harry said.
because she's not completely unconscious.
On the floor at their feet, Beth groaned. Her leg moved.
She's still able to control it somehow, Norman said.
She's very strong.
Can we inject her?
Norman shook his head. There was no time to go back for the syringe. Anyway, if they injected her and it didn't work, it would be time wasted.
Hit her again?
Harry said.
Harder? Kill her?
No, Norman said.
Killing her is the only way...
No, Norman said, thinking, we didn't kill you, Harry, when we had the chance.
If you won't kill her, then you can't do anything about that timer, Harry said, so we better get the hell out.
They ran for the airlock.
How much time is left? Harry said.
They were in the A-sill airlock, trying to put the suit on Beth. She was groaning. Blood was matted on the back of her head. Beth struggled a little, making it more difficult.
Jesus, Beth! How much time, Norman?
7.5 minutes, maybe less. Her legs were in. They quickly pushed her arms in, zipped up the chest. They turned on her air. Norman helped Harry with his suit.
Attention, please. 7 minutes and counting.
Harry said, how much time do you figure to get to the surface?
2.5 minutes after we get inside the sub, Norman said.
Great, Harry said.
Norman snapped Harry's helmet locked.
Let's go.
Harry descended into the water, and Norman lowered Beth's unconscious body. She was heavy with the tank and weights.
Come on, Norman.
Norman plunged into the water. At the submarine, Norman climbed up to the hatch entrance, but the untethered sub rolled unpredictably with his weight. Harry, standing on the bottom, tried to push Beth up toward Norman, but Beth kept bending over at the waist. Norman, grabbing for her, fell off the sub and slid to the bottom.
Attention, please. 6 minutes and counting.
Hurry, Norman. 6 minutes.
I heard, damn it.
Norman got to his feet, climbed back on the sub, but now his suit was muddy, his gloves slippery. Harry was counting.
529, 528, 527.
Norman caught Beth's arm, but she slipped away again.
Damn it, Norman, hold on to her.
I'm trying.
Here she is again.
Attention, please. 5 minutes and counting.
The alarm was now high-pitched, beeping insistently. They had to shout over it to be heard.
Harry, give her to me. Well, here, take her.
Missed.
Here.
Norman finally caught Beth's air hose in his hand, just behind the helmet. He wondered if it would pull out, but he had to risk it. Gripping the hose, he hauled Beth up until she lay on her back on the top of the sub. Then he eased her down into the hatch.
429, 428.
Norman had trouble keeping his balance. He got one of Beth's legs into the hatch, but the other knee was bent, jammed against the lip of the hatch. He couldn't get her down. Every time he leaned forward one bend or leg, the whole submarine tipped and he would start to lose his balance again.
416, 415.
Would you stop counting and do something?
Harry pressed his body against the side of the submarine, countering the rolling with his weight. Norman leaned forward and pressed Beth's knee straight. She slid easily into the open hatch. Norman climbed in after her. It was a one-man airlock, but Beth was unconscious and could not work the controls. He would have to do it for her.
Attention, please. 4 minutes and counting.
He was cramped in the airlock, his body pressed up against Beth, chest to chest, her helmet banging against his. With difficulty, he pulled the hatch closed over his head. He blew out the water in a furious rush of compressed air. Unsupported by the water, Beth's body now sagged heavily against him. He reached around her for the handle to the inner hatch. Beth's body blocked his way. He tried to twist her around sideways. In the confined space, he couldn't get any leverage on the body. Beth was like a dead weight. He tried to shift her body around to get to the hatch. The whole submarine began to sway. Harry was climbing up the side.
What the hell's going on in there?
Harry, will you shut up?
Well, what's the delay?
Norman's hand closed on the inner latch handle. He shoved it down, but the door didn't move. The door was hinged to swing inward. He couldn't open it with Beth in the hatch with him. It was too crowded. Her body blocked the movement of the door. Harry, we've got a problem.
Jesus Christ, 3:30.
Norman began to sweat. They were really in trouble now.
Harry, I've got to pass her out to you and go in alone.
Jesus, Norman!
Norman flooded the airlock, opened the upper hatch once again. Harry's balance atop the submarine was precarious. He grabbed Beth by the air hose, dragged her up. Norman reached up to close the hatch.
Harry, can you get her feet out of the way?
I'm trying to keep my balance here.
Can't you see her feet are blocking?
Irritably, Norman pushed Beth's feet aside. The hatch clanged down. The air blasted past him. The hatch pressurized.
Attention, please. 2 minutes and counting.
He was inside the submarine. The instruments glowed green. He opened the inner hatch.
Norman? Try and get her down, Norman said. Do it as fast as you can.
But he was thinking they were in terrible trouble. At least 30 seconds to get Beth into the hatch, and 30 seconds more for Harry to come down. A minute altogether.
She's in. Vent it.
Norman jumped for the air vent, blew out the water.
How'd you get her in so fast, Harry?
Nature's way, Harry said, to get people through tight spaces.
And before Norman could ask what that meant, he had opened the hatch and saw that Harry had pushed Beth into the airlock head first. He grabbed her shoulders and eased her onto the floor of the submarine, then slammed the hatch shut. Moments later, he heard the blast of air as Harry, too, vented the airlock. The submarine hatch clanged. Harry came forward.
Christ, 1:40, Harry said. Do you know how to work this thing?
Yes. Norman sat in the seat, placed his hands on the controls. They heard the whine of the props, felt the rumble. The sub lurched, moved off the bottom.
1:30. How long did you say to the surface?
2:30, Norman said, cranking up the ascent rate. He pushed it past 6.6 to the far end of the dial. They heard a high-pitched shriek of air as the ballast tanks blew. The sub nosed up sharply, began to rise swiftly.
Is this as fast as it goes?
Yes.
Jesus!
Take it easy, Harry. Looking back down, they could see the habitat with its lights, and then the long lines of explosives set over the spaceship itself. They rose past the high fin of the spacecraft, leaving it behind, seeing only black water now.
1:20.
900 feet, Norman said.
There was very little sensation of movement, only the changing dials on the instrument panel to tell them they were moving.
It's not fast enough,
Harry said.
That's a hell of a lot of explosive down there.
It is fast enough, Norman thought, correcting him.
The shock wave will crush us like a can of sardines,
Harry said, shaking his head. The shock wave will not harm us.
800 feet.
40 seconds, Harry said. We'll never make it.
We'll make it.
They were at 700 feet, rising fast. The water now had a faint blue color, sunlight filtering down.
30 seconds,
Harry said.
Where are we? 29? 8?
620 feet, Norman said. 610. They looked back down the side of the sub. They could barely discern the habitat, faint pinpricks of light far beneath them. Beth coughed.
It's too late now, Harry said. I knew from the beginning we'd never make it.
Yes, we will, Norman said.
10 seconds,
Harry said.
9? 8? Brace yourself!
Norman pulled Beth to his chest as the explosion rocked the submarine, spinning it like a toy, upending it, then righting them again, and lifting them in a giant upward surge.
Mama!
Harry shouted, but they were still rising. They were okay.
We did it!
200 feet, Norman said.
The water outside was now light blue. He pushed buttons, slowing the ascent. They were going up very fast. Harry was screaming, pounding Norman on the back.
We did it! God damn it, you son of a bitch! We did it! We survived! I never thought we would. We survived.
Norman was having trouble seeing the instruments for tears in his eyes. And then he had to squint as bright sunlight streamed into the bubble canopy as they surfaced. And they saw calm seas, sky, and fluffy clouds.
Do you see that?
Harry cried. He was screaming in Norman's ear.
Do you see that? It is a perfect goddamned day.
0000 hours. Norman awoke to see a brilliant shaft of light streaming through the single porthole, shining down on the chemical toilet in the corner of the decompression chamber. He lay on his bunk and looked around the chamber. A horizontal cylinder, 50 feet long. Bunks, a metal table and chairs in the center of the cylinder. Toilet behind a small partition. Harry snored in the bunk above him. Across the chamber, Beth slept, one arm flung over her face. Faintly, from a distance, he heard men shouting. Norman yawned and swung off the bunk. His body was sore, but he was otherwise all right. He walked to the shining porthole and looked out, squinting in the bright Pacific sun. He saw the rear deck of the research ship John Hawes. The white helicopter pad, heavy coiled cables, the tubular metal frame of an underwater robot. The Navy crew was lowering a second robot over the side with a lot of shouting and swearing and waving of hands. Norman had heard their voices faintly through the thick steel walls of the chamber. Near the chamber itself, a muscular seaman rolled a large green tank marked Oxygen alongside a dozen other tanks on the deck. The three-man medical crew, which supervised the decompression chamber, played cards. Looking through the inch-thick glass of the porthole, Norman felt as if he were peering into a miniature world to which he had little connection. A kind of terrarium populated by interesting and exotic specimens. This new world was as alien to him as the dark ocean world had once seemed from inside the habitat. He watched the crew slap down their cards on a wooden packing crate, watched them laugh and gesture as the game proceeded. They never glanced in his direction, never looked at the decompression chamber. Norman didn't understand these young men. Were they supposed to be paying attention to the decompression? They looked young and inexperienced to Norman. Focused on their card game, they seemed indifferent to the huge metal chamber nearby, indifferent to the three survivors inside the chamber, and indifferent to the larger meaning of the mission, to the news the survivors had brought back to the surface. These cheerful Navy card players didn't seem to give a damn about Norman's mission. But perhaps they didn't know. He turned back to the chamber, sat down at the table. His knee throbbed, and the skin was swollen around the white bandage. He had been treated by a Navy physician during their transfer from the submarine to the decompression chamber. He had been taken off the Minisub Deep Star 3 in a pressurized diving bell, and from there had been transferred to the large chamber on the deck of the ship. The SDC, the Navy called it, the surface decompression chamber. They were going to spend 4 days here. Norman wasn't sure how long he had been here so far. They had all immediately gone to sleep, and there was no clock in the chamber. The face of his own wristwatch was smashed, although he didn't remember it happening. On the table in front of him, someone had scratched USN sucks into the surface. Norman ran his fingers over the grooves and remembered the grooves in the silver sphere. But he and Harry and Beth were in the hands of the Navy now. And he thought, what are we going to tell them? What are we going to tell them? Beth said. It was several hours later. Beth and Harry had awakened. And now they were all sitting around the scarred metal table. None of them had made any attempt to talk to the crew outside. It was, Norman thought, as if they shared an unspoken agreement to remain in isolation a while longer. I think we'll have to tell them everything, Harry said. I don't think we should, Norman said. He was surprised by the strength of his conviction, the firmness of his own voice. I agree, Beth said. I'm not sure the world is ready for that sphere. I certainly wasn't. She gave Norman a sheepish look. He put his hand on her shoulder. That's fine, Harry said. But look at it from the standpoint of the Navy. The Navy has mounted a large and expensive operation. 5 people have died, and 2 habitats have been destroyed. They're going to want answers, and they're going to keep asking until they get them. We can refuse to talk, Beth said. That won't make any difference, Harry said. Remember, the Navy has all the tapes. That's right, the tapes, Norman said. He had forgotten about the videotapes they had brought up in the submarine. Dozens of tapes, documenting everything that had happened in the habitat during their time underwater, documenting the squid, the deaths, the sphere, documenting everything.
We should have destroyed those tapes, Beth said.
Perhaps we should have, Harry said. But it's too late now. We can't prevent the Navy from getting the answers they want.
Norman sighed.
Harry was right. At this point, there was no way to conceal what had happened, or to prevent the Navy from finding out about the sphere and the power it conveyed. That power would represent a kind of ultimate weapon, the ability to overcome your enemies simply by imagining it had happened. It was frightening in its implications, and there was nothing they could do about it, unless... I think we can prevent them from knowing, Norman said.
How?
Harry said. We still have the power, don't we?
I guess so.
And that power, Norman said, consists of the ability to make anything happen simply by thinking it.
Yes?
Then we can prevent the Navy from knowing. We can decide to forget the whole thing. Harry frowned. That's an interesting question. Whether we have the power to forget the power.
I think we should forget it, Beth said. That sphere is too dangerous.
They fell silent, considering the implications of forgetting the sphere. Because forgetting would not merely prevent the Navy from knowing about the sphere, it would erase all knowledge of it, including their own, make it vanish from human consciousness as if it had never existed in the first place, remove it from the awareness of the human species forever.
Big step, Harry said.
After all we've been through, just to forget about it.
It's because of all we've been through, Harry, Beth said.
Let's face it, we didn't handle ourselves very well. Norman noticed that she spoke without rancor now, her previous combative edge gone.
I'm afraid that's true, Norman said.
The sphere was built to test whatever intelligent life might pick it up, and we simply failed that test.
Is that what you think the sphere was made for? Harry said.
I don't.
Then what? Norman said.
Well, Harry said, look at it this way. Suppose you were an intelligent bacterium floating in space, and you came upon one of our communication satellites in orbit around the Earth. You would think, what a strange alien object this is. Let's explore it. Suppose you opened it up and crawled inside. You would find it very interesting in there, with lots of huge things to puzzle over. But eventually, you might climb into one of the fuel cells, and the hydrogen would kill you. And your last thought would be, this alien device was obviously made to test bacterial intelligence and to kill us if we make a false step. Now, that would be correct from the standpoint of the dying bacterium, but that wouldn't be correct at all from the standpoint of the beings who made the satellite. From our point of view, the communication satellite has nothing to do with intelligent bacteria. We don't even know that there are intelligent bacteria out there. We're just trying to communicate, and we've made what we consider a quite ordinary device to do it.
You mean the sphere might not be a message or a trophy or a trap at all?
That's right, Harry said. The sphere may have nothing to do with the search for other life forms or testing life as we might imagine those activities to occur. It may be an accident that the sphere causes such profound changes in us.
But why would someone build such a machine? Norman said.
And that's the same question an intelligent bacterium would ask about a communication satellite. Why would anyone build such a thing?
For that matter, Beth said, it may not be a machine. The sphere may be a life form. It may be alive.
Possible,
Harry said, nodding. Beth said, so, if the sphere is alive, do we have an obligation to keep it alive?
We don't know if it is alive.
Norman sat back in the chair.
All this speculation is interesting, he said, but when you get down to it, we don't really know anything about the sphere.
In fact, we shouldn't even be calling it the sphere.
We probably should just call it sphere, because we don't know what it is. We don't know where it came from. We don't know whether it's living or dead. We don't know how it came to be inside that spaceship. We don't know anything about it except what we imagine. And what we imagine says more about us than it does about the sphere.
Right, Harry said. Because it's literally a sort of mirror for us. Norman said.
Speaking of which, there's another possibility, Harry said.
It may not be alien at all. It may be man-made.
That took Norman completely by surprise. Harry explained.
Consider, Harry said.
A ship from our own future went through a black hole into another universe, or another part of our universe. We cannot imagine what would happen as a result of that.
But suppose there were some major distortion of time. Suppose that ship, which left with a human crew in the year 2043, actually has been in transit for thousands and thousands of years. Couldn't the human crew have invented it during that time?
I don't think that's likely, Beth said.
Well, let's consider for a moment, Beth, Harry said gently.
Norman noticed that Harry wasn't arrogant anymore. They were all in this together, Norman thought, and they were working together in a way they never had before. All the time underwater they had been at odds, but now they functioned smoothly together, coordinated, a team.
There is a real problem about the future, Harry was saying, and we don't admit it. We assume we can see into the future better than we really can. Leonardo da Vinci tried to make a helicopter 500 years ago, and Jules Verne predicted a submarine 100 years ago. From instances like that, we tend to believe that the future is predictable in a way that it really isn't, because neither Leonardo nor Jules Verne could ever have imagined, say, a computer. The very concept of a computer implies too much knowledge that was simply inconceivable at the time those men were alive. It was, if you will, information that came out of nowhere later on. And we're no wiser sitting here now. We couldn't have guessed that men would send a ship through a black hole. We didn't even suspect the existence of black holes until a few years ago. And we certainly can't guess what men might accomplish thousands of years in the future.
Assuming the sphere was made by men.
Yes, assuming that.
And if it wasn't? If it's really a sphere from an alien civilization, are we justified in erasing all human knowledge of this alien life?
I don't know, Harry said, shaking his head. If we decide to forget the sphere,
then it'll be gone, Norman said. Beth stared at the table.
I wish we could ask someone, she said finally.
There isn't anybody to ask, Norman said.
But can we really forget it, Beth said. Will it work?
There was a long silence.
Yes, Harry said finally. There's no question about it. And I think we already have evidence that we will forget about it.
That solves a logical problem that bothered me from the beginning when we first explored the ship, because something very important was missing from that ship.
Yes?
What?
Any sign that the builders of the ship already knew travel through a black hole was possible.
I don't follow you, Norman said.
Well, Harry said, the three of us have already seen a spaceship that has been through a black hole. We've walked through it, so we know that such travel is possible.
Yes?
Yet 50 years from now, men are going to build that ship in a very tentative, experimental way, with apparently no knowledge that the ship has already been found 50 years in their past. There is no sign on the ship that the builders already know of its existence in the past.
Maybe it's one of those time paradoxes, Beth said. You know, how you can't go back and meet yourself in the past? Harry shook his head.
I don't think it's a paradox, he said.
I think that all knowledge of that ship is going to be lost.
You mean we are going to forget it?
Yes,
Harry said.
And frankly, I think it's a much better solution. For a long time while we were down there, I assumed none of us would ever get back alive. That was the only explanation I could think of. That's why I wanted to make out my will.
But if we decide to forget...
Exactly, Harry said. If we decide to forget, that will produce the same result.
The knowledge will be gone forever, Norman said quietly. He found himself hesitating. Now that they had arrived at this moment, he was strangely reluctant to proceed. He ran his fingertips over the scarred table, touching the surface, as if it might provide an answer. In a sense, he thought, all we consist of is memories. Our personalities are constructed from memories. Our lives are organized around memories. Our cultures are built upon the foundation of shared memories that we call history and science. But now, to give up a memory, to give up knowledge... to give up the past.
It's not easy, Harry said, shaking his head.
No, Norman said. It's not. In fact, he found it so difficult he wondered if he was experiencing a human characteristic as fundamental as sexual desire. He simply could not give up this knowledge. The information seemed so important to him, the implications so fascinating, his entire being rebelled against the idea of forgetting. Well, Harry said, I think we have to do it anyway. I was thinking of Ted, Beth said, and Barnes, and the others. We're the only ones who know how they really died, what they gave their lives for. And if we forget, when we forget, Norman said firmly. She has a point, Harry said. If we forget, how do we handle all the details, all the loose ends? I don't think that's a problem, Norman said. The unconscious has tremendous creative powers, as we've seen. The details will be taken care of unconsciously. It's like the way we get dressed in the morning. When we dress, we don't necessarily think of every detail, the belt and the socks and so on. We just make a basic overall decision about how we want to look, and then we get dressed. Even so, Harry said, we still better make the overall decision, because we all have the power. And if we imagine different stories, we'll get confusion. All right, Norman said. Let's agree on what happened. Why did we come here? I thought it was going to be an airplane crash. Me too. Okay, suppose it was an airplane crash. Fine. Then what happened? The Navy sent some people down to investigate the crash, and a problem developed. Wait a minute, what problem? The squid? No, better a technical problem. Something to do with the storm? Life support systems failed during the storm? Yes, good. Life support systems failed during the storm. And several people died as a result? Wait a minute. Let's not go so fast. What made the life support systems fail? Beth said, the habitat developed a leak and the seawater corrupted the scrubber canisters in B-cell, releasing a toxic gas. Could that have happened? Norman said. Yes, easily. And several people died as a result of that accident. Okay. But we survived. Yes. Why? Norman said. We were in the other habitat? Norman shook his head. The other habitat was destroyed, too. Maybe it was destroyed later with the explosives. Too complicated, Norman said. Let's keep it simple. It was an accident which happened suddenly and unexpectedly. The habitat sprang a leak, and the scrubbers failed, and as a result, most of the people died, but we didn't because... We were in the sub? Okay, Norman said. We were in the sub when the systems failed, so we survived and the others didn't. Why were we in the sub? We were transferring the tapes, according to the schedule. Then what about the tapes? Harry said. What will they show? The tapes will confirm our story, Norman said. Everything will be consistent with the story, including the Navy people who sent us down in the first place, and including us, too. We won't remember anything but this story. And we won't have the power anymore? Beth said, frowning. No, Norman said. Not anymore. Okay, Harry said. Beth seemed to think about it longer, biting her lip, but finally she nodded. Okay. Norman took a deep breath and looked at Beth and Harry. Are we ready to forget the sphere and the fact that we once had the power to make things happen by thinking them? They nodded. Beth became suddenly agitated, twisting in her chair. But how do we do it exactly? We just do it, Norman said. Close your eyes and tell yourself to forget it. Beth said, but are you sure we should do it? Really sure? She was still agitated, moving nervously. Yes, Beth. You just give up the power. And we have to do it all together, she said. At the same time. Okay, Harry said. On the count of three. They closed their eyes. One. With his eyes closed, Norman thought, people always forget that they have power anyway. Two, Harry said. And then Norman focused his mind. With a sudden intensity, he saw the sphere again, shining like a star, perfect and polished, and he thought, I want to forget I ever saw the sphere. And in his mind's eye, the sphere vanished.
Three,
Harry said. Three what? Norman said. His eyes ached and burned. He rubbed them with his thumb and forefinger, then opened them. Beth and Harry were sitting around the table in the decompression chamber with him. They all looked tired and depressed. But that was to be expected, he thought, considering what they had all been through. Three what? Norman said again. Oh, Harry said. I was just thinking out loud. Only three of us left. Beth sighed. Norman saw tears in her eyes. She fumbled in her pocket for a Kleenex, blew her nose. You can't blame yourselves, Norman said. It was an accident. There was nothing we could do about it. I know, Harry said. But those people suffocating while we were in the submarine. I keep hearing the screams. God, I wish it had never happened. There was a silence. Beth blew her nose again. Norman wished it had never happened, too, but wishing wasn't going to make a difference now. We can't change what happened, Norman said. We can only learn to accept it.
I know,
Beth said. I've had a lot of experience with accident trauma, he said. You simply have to keep telling yourself that you have no reason to be guilty. What happened, happened. Some people died, and you were spared. It isn't anybody's fault. It's just one of those things. It was an accident. I know that, Harry said. But I still feel bad. Keep telling yourself it's just one of those things, Norman said. Keep reminding yourself of that. He got up from the table. They ought to eat, he thought. They ought to have food. I'm going to ask for food.
I'm not hungry, Beth said.
I know that, but we should eat anyway. Norman walked to the porthole. The attentive Navy crew saw him at once, pressed the radio intercom. Do anything for you, Dr. Johnson? Yes, Norman said. We need some food. Right away, sir. Norman saw the sympathy on the faces of the Navy crew. These senior men understood what a shock it must be for the three survivors. Dr. Johnson, are your people ready to talk to somebody now? Talk? Yes, sir. The intelligence experts have been reviewing the videotapes from the submarine, and they have some questions for you. What about? Norman asked, without much interest. Well, when you were transferred to the SDC, Dr. Adams mentioned something about a squid. Did he? Yes, sir. Only there doesn't seem to be any squid recorded on the tapes. I don't remember any squid, Norman said, puzzled. He turned to Harry. Did you say something about a squid, Harry? Harry frowned. A squid? I don't think so. Norman turned back to the Navy man. What do the videotapes show, exactly? Well, the tapes go right up to the time when the air in the habitat... You know, the accident? Yes, Norman said. I remember the accident. From the tapes, we think we know what happened. Apparently, there was a leak in the habitat wall, and the scrubber cylinders got wet. They became inoperable, and the ambient atmosphere went bad. I see. It must have happened very suddenly, sir. Yes, Johnson said. Yes, it did. So, are you ready to talk to someone now? I think so, yes. Norman turned away from the porthole. He put his hands in the pockets of his jacket and felt a piece of paper. He pulled out a picture and stared at it curiously. It was a photograph of a red Corvette. Norman wondered where the picture had come from. Probably a car that belonged to someone else who had worn the jacket before Norman. Probably one of the Navy people who had died in the underwater disaster. Norman shivered, crumpled the picture in his fist, and tossed it into the trash. He didn't need any mementos. He remembered that disaster only too well. He knew he would never forget it for the rest of his life. He glanced back at Beth and Harry. They both looked tired. Beth stared into space, preoccupied with her own thoughts. But her face was serene. Despite the hardships of their time underwater, Norman thought she looked almost beautiful. You know, Beth, he said, you look lovely. Beth did not seem to hear, but then she turned toward him slowly.
Why, thank you, Norman, she said.
And she smiled. End of Sphere by Michael Crichton. Narrated by Bob Askey in the studios of Talking Books Publishing Company for the Library of Congress.